Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, thank you for downloading. Luke Jones here, not Matt Chorley. I'd like to start this episode of the podcast with an apology. The British people have made immense sacrifices in the ongoing battle against COVID-19, and I now fear that the fact that the podcast was not uploaded yesterday may have become a distraction in the fight against the virus. Working in this office is an immense privilege. I try to do right by you all, to behave with civility and decency, and act to the high standards you rightly expect from the Times Red Box podcast. Unfortunately, though, you didn't get Tim Shipman taking you through PMQs yesterday. Apologies. Deputy heads will roll. But welcome back to the podcast. And today we've got loads in store. Our fantastic columnist will be up in a moment. After that, we will hear about China, continuing this show's ongoing international relations. Can we call it a tour? It's kind of a tour around different countries and what they want. We've already heard about Vladimir Putin and Russia. And now China. What does Xi Jinping want? Who is she? What does she want? We will delve into that after our columnists, Carol Lewis and James Marriott. Shall we start with, let's start with Christmas parties, shall we? We've been talking about it quite a bit on the programme already. Carol, where do you sit on the spectrum of people saying, you know, one end, this is an outrage and will undermine public health messaging, or who really cares? Where do you sit?
So last year, if you wanted a Christmas party, you had to claim it was a work meeting.
Yes.
This year, if you want to have a work meeting, you have to claim it's a Christmas party. I mean, it's utterly bonkers, isn't it? So you told us last night we have to work from home, but we can still go out. We have to wear a mask on the tube, but not in a nightclub. We have to show a vaccine pass to go to a club, but not to go to a restaurant. I mean, it just makes no sense whatsoever. And coming after Patterson and Peppa Pig, parties, I just kind of seals this idea that Boris doesn't really know what he's doing. He's going in all different directions. And it adds fuel for the anti-vaxxers and the COVID deniers to get in there. And as Starmer says, Boris has made fools of all of us. Mm. So I don't think it's just a petty row about a few parties and a quiz and a cheese and wine, although clearly they didn't know about the martini. I don't think it is petty from that point of view. I think if we are all in this together, if it is really a danger, if we are going to follow the science, then this does matter.
And James, what about you? Did you watch or listen to the COVID briefing last night and think that Prime Minister has got his hand firmly on the tiller?
It just seems just so amazingly chaotic, doesn't it? And now he's had a baby, it just seems even more... even the baby seems like a kind of chaotic event. I just didn't see that coming.
Your mind is absolutely blown by that, because you just think the stress behind the scenes.
I know. I mean, the fact that all this was going on yesterday and he was presumably he was on the verge of having a baby or maybe was trying to encourage the baby to arrive as soon as possible. I don't know if you can tell a baby to arrive. I quite like the idea that the baby is a kind of dead cat, and I feel they should maybe give it an incredibly ridiculous and exotic name,
such as
I don't know. I mean,
Allegra.
Allegra. Yes, exactly. And you just sort of turn the baby, give the baby a stupid enough name, the baby itself will attract all the news attention. I think that's all you can do at this point.
Oh, I see. But put the even the baby a day old, put the baby out of some kind of
make the baby a dead cat. Yeah, yes. Maybe call the baby dead cat or something, just to.
Well, we've had more news on the parties front, because of course there's this investigation which the Prime Minister announced yesterday into all of these. You heard it on this programme during PMQs. Well, in the Commons a few minutes ago, the Paymaster General has been updating the Commons on the status of those investigations into those various parties.
Now, I can confirm to the House that the Cabinet Secretary's investigation will establish the facts surrounding the following. Allegations made of a gathering at number 10 Downing Street on the 27th of November 2020, a gathering at the Department for Education on the 10th of December 2020, and allegations made of a gathering at number 10 Downing Street on the 18th of December 2020. Now, the primary purpose of the Cabinet Secretary's investigation will be to establish swiftly a general understanding of the nature of the gatherings, including attendance, the setting and the purpose, and with reference to adherence to the guidance in place at the time. Now, if required, the investigation will establish whether individual disciplinary action is warranted. Now, Mr. Speaker, the work will be undertaken by officials in the Cabinet Office at the direction of the Cabinet Secretary with support from the Government Legal Department. Now, those officials will have access to all relevant records and be able to speak to members of staff. Now, as with all internal investigations, if during the course of the work any evidence emerges of behaviour that is potentially a criminal offence, the matter will be referred to the police and the Cabinet Office's work may be paused.
The word if doing a lot of heavy lifting there. That was Michael Ellis, the Paymaster General, updating the Commons a few minutes ago. That debate and discussion continues, but we'll keep an ear across it and bring you any more interesting nuggets as and when they happen. Carol, do you have full confidence in all those investigations as laid out there?
Absolutely not. I think it was very obvious when he said the word gathering and all the heckling. I think they're going to try and pin this on a technicality that it wasn't actually a party, it was a gathering of work colleagues. I mean, not quite a business meeting. I don't think they could pull that off, but I think they are going to try. There are some loopholes where if it was in a public department, there could be a gathering, but not a party. And I think they'll have to then be painful conversations about what the difference between a gathering and a party is.
Is the anger, James, slightly overtaking us here? Because in thinking about the risk at that time, OK, we were just coming out of a lockdown in November. There were Tier 2 restrictions in London where this is alleged to have taken place in December. These people were working together. They were in an office. They then had drinks and cheese and wine and may have not been doing much work but had frivolities. But they were there in the same office where they were usually any day meeting people that they would normally see. Was this really a risky thing to do when many of us were breaking rules? There were plenty of people who we all know who were doing things that they shouldn't have done at that time.
I mean, I take your point, but I just think if you're the people in charge of making the rules, you're making these rules for the country, it's kind of incumbent on you, I think, to stick to them more closely than anybody. Otherwise, it's a messaging thing as well, isn't it? And it's just sort of, it should be a matter of principle. I think any competent government would have just been so strict about this, wouldn't it? They'd have just been like, we have to be so careful. You know, this is a huge thing we're asking the country to do. We have to be incredibly sure not to be hypocritical about it. And the fact that we're careless about it just seems, I don't know, just seems so sort of indicative of the nature of the government. And I just can't imagine why they weren't super strict and careful, because I just feel like you would be.
Because, Carol, do you agree? Because by that point, remember, we'd had that whole Stooshy over Rita Ora, we had the Sky News party. There were plenty of headlines, footballers as well, breaking lockdown. It was definitely in the public consciousness, people being caught out having parties and doing things that they shouldn't be.
No, I agree with James. I mean, it makes a big difference. This is with number 10. And I think one of the parties was the day before they announced that we couldn't really have Christmas. So I think it does matter. They should have set an example. They'd also had plenty of warning. We'd had plenty of things like Barnard Castle.
Yeah.
We'd had Neil Ferguson. And, you know, we'd had all of these markers where everyone had said, look, we're all in it together. They need to pull their act together. And clearly they didn't take it seriously. They knew one rule for them, one rule for us.
Let's move on to some other things in the papers. One thing reported in the Times today is some comments from Liz Truss talking yesterday about pride in Britain. Britons must embrace the history of the empire, warts and all, Liz Truss said, the Foreign Secretary, if it's to stand up to hostile states. James, how does that sit with you? This is something which is constantly being debated back and forth, isn't it?
It's something that always really confuses me because it's my opinion that basically part of being a mature country that's capable of having, you know, reasonable conversations about is accepting that not everything the country did in the past was wonderful. I mean, that would just be an absurd thing to expect of any country. And I always get really baffled that the sort of strain in thinking that people want to think that everything Britain did was magnificent, because obviously it wasn't, and obviously we ran an enormous global empire, and obviously the outcomes of that are going to be in the, obviously many terrible things happened. It seems sort of strange to imagine that wouldn't be the case. And I always think it's kind of amazing. I don't know, it just always seems the most kind of extraordinary kind of bias that just because you live in a country, you begin to think that everything it did was marvellous. Whereas, you know, you can imagine full well that if we had been the country that had been conquered by another global empire, we would be very unhappy about it. And
yeah.
It seems so strange, the sort of double thing that goes on for people there. It's not something I particularly understand. I don't feel like I particularly mind knowing that, you know, Britain did awful things in the past. I don't feel sort of personally offended by it. I think it's just history.
But it's the word embrace, isn't it, Carol? And does that sort of necessarily say accept and consider and move forward? Or does it say celebrate and defend?
I think the word embrace does imply the latter, and I think what we need to do is the former. We need to accept it. I think we've gone from celebrating our colonialism to loathing everything about it. And I think, like, as James says, what we need to do is end up somewhere in the middle where we accept the things that we did. And that they are part of who we are as a society, but also how it perhaps has shaped or is shaping some of the things that are happening, like Brexit and the infighting. I mean, it was interesting that Truss wasn't at PMQ's to hear the party debate, because she was actually, you know, sort of talking about we need to stop this petty infighting and start looking outwardly. Unfortunately, she seemed to then imply that autocratic regimes were already on this, and I think that was perhaps a wrong parallel to draw. You know, China and Russia aren't looking backwards, they're looking forwards, and now we need to do the same. I don't think we should take any cues from them whatsoever. But yes, I think we do need to spend some time accepting who we are and how that shapes us today.
James, tell us about your column today. You're looking back on Christopher Hitchens. Well, not necessarily looking back, but more, I guess, looking around at his incredible persistence in terms of YouTube videos. I mean, like, he pops up on TikTok. It's incredible.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by this kind of major cultural transition that's happened in the last sort of 20 years or so, from a culture that was predominantly, a kind of political and cultural discourse that was predominantly conducted in long form, in print, you know, usually at reasonable length, to this sudden total transformation where everything happens so quickly, everything happens on screens, on Twitter, on YouTube, and there's just been this enormous cultural revolution in the way we communicate with each other about our politics. And Christopher Hitchens, looking back on him, it's the 10th anniversary of his death next week, the famous sort of contrarian journalism, fascinates me as a figure who stood between those two worlds and who started out as an essayist, writing these, you know, long essays on, you know, Proust and American, you know, long essays in American politics, who completely sort of seemed to anticipate in the later stage of his career the world we're in now, with these incredibly kind of contrarian performances, flinging around insults at audience members who asked him questions, using outrageous words. There's a video of him online, just accusing an audience member of being a fascist. And this all suddenly seems very, it really anticipates the way that our political and cultural discourse is now. And he's a kind of fascinating figure, because I think he's the kind of one person from that generation who for better or for worse, and I can think predominantly for the worse, seemed to kind of get the zeitgeist of where things were moving. And looking back at him now, he just seems kind of almost a very 21st century figure, even, you know, a very modern figure, even, you know, 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah. And Carol, is this, I mean, could this simply be put as insults play well?
Yes, except I think Hitchens actually was well-read, clever and witty, and could, if needed to, back up his arguments. It's a bit like when you hear people stand in front of a Picasso and say, oh, my five-year-old could have painted that. Well, actually, no, they couldn't, because Picasso was classically trained and actually did know what he was doing. I think that Hitchens did have the background to do it. I suspect most people on Twitter who shout at me lazy journalism and drivel, but in fact, I don't suspect, I know, they don't even read the articles. Mm. They don't actually have any backing for their arguments. So I think I agree with James that perhaps he was ahead of his time in some ways by calling someone a crackpot. But in other forms, I think we've taken it to the extreme in places like Twitter, where you are just sort of heckled with idiot, drivel, lazy journalists and so on. But people don't actually know the arguments behind it. Mm. They haven't read the articles. I think we've gone another layer still, unfortunately.
And James, what about the situation now in terms of, so Carol, they're saying that, you know, at least Christopher Hitchens had the knowledge and being well read to back up everything he did. Is that the same with people who have taken on that mantle and take it forward?
I don't think so. I mean, I also think being educated doesn't necessarily give you the right to shout insults at people. And I always was suspicious of Christopher Hitchens, that how much his appearance of being very educated and well read was the way he presented himself, his very sort of posh voice, his very confident manner. My personal opinion is that whenever you read a Christopher Hitchens essay on something you really know about, and sometimes when I read some of his essays on literature, I'm just like, how well read were you really? There's this long essay on the French writer Proust I was reading the other night when I was preparing for this piece. And an awful lot of his essay on Proust is about like the novel's first sentence and the first 100 pages. And I'm kind of like, I wonder how much of it was a performance for him and how much we're willing to be taken in by people who, you know, have posh voices and are very, you know, present themselves very confidently. And I also think, you know, being educated doesn't mean that you have a license to be rude and insulting to people, I think. Hmm. I don't know. I don't.
But is that taken on still, Carol? Do you think there's still people who are presenting that kind of, that sheen, that kind of pseudo-intellectualism to what they do?
Yes, probably. I don't know how taken in we are by it still, because it tends not to be in the spoken form. It tends to be, you know, in 150 characters on a platform. So you can't tell what people's accents are like or their education, and very often you can't tell from their tweets either. So yes, I mean, he was perhaps taking advantage of his time. I mean, I totally accept what James says. I don't sit at night reading Proust, so perhaps I was taken in a little.
That was Carol Lewis and James Marriott. Next, what does China want?
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Times Redbox podcast. I'm Luke Jones, not Matt Chorley. Now, China. Xi Jinping. Who is she? What does she want? His power at home and on the world stage has grown since he took office in 2014. In the UK, EU and the US, there are plenty of prominent politicians hawkish about China's human rights record, its economic power in the developing world. Yesterday, the UK followed the US, Australia and Canada to stage a diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympics being held in Beijing. But is that the best approach? We will hear in a moment the EU and UK views. First, the US. Max Baucus was US ambassador to China during Obama's second term. First of all, how is his welcome in Beijing?
Well, it was very warm, but also special in the sense that all ambassadors, when they arrive, present their credentials to the chief of state. So I had to present my credentials to President Xi. But the interesting little sidelight was First Lady Michelle Obama was scheduled to come on over to China with her mother and two children about 2-3 days after I arrived. And ordinarily, it takes 2 weeks for a new ambassador to have his credentials presented and received by the head of state. So the Chinese were very accommodating. They could not have been better. And frankly, they rushed me to the head of the line. In fact, they had me present my credentials to President Xi in a side room so the other ambassadors could not see it. who were end of the line, because I was put in the head of the line. So it was very nice. We had a nice chat, President Xi and I. We talked about First Lady and the family. And it was just a lot of small talk. And after a while, he turned to me. He said to me, well, you've got to get the airport. You've got to get there to receive the First Lady when she arrives. So let me help you get there. So they're very warm, very accommodating in that sense. Yes. And after that, it was basically just business as usual.
And when you say business as usual, what were you able to glean in those early days? Because there were early days, not just for you, but also for Xi Jinping himself. He hadn't been in that position for long, I guess, when you got there. What could you glean about what he was after in terms of his foreign policy aims?
Well, he was, first of all, President Xi is hard to read. He keeps his cards close to his vest. He's poker-faced. He has kind of an enigmatic smile, but he is almost always smiling. It's not a dour expression. It's sort of a smiling, pickish, Mona Lisa sort of smile. You make points to him. He'd listen very, very civilly, never argumentative, never, ever argumentative, never, ever say anything personal in any way toward me or the United States or anybody else. It was really, he's quite civil that way, but he wouldn't say much. You had to spend most of your time with him and with other Chinese officials making your point, taking your brief from the president to him or to others. They would listen very politely. And I was very lucky, frankly. I was able to see anybody I wanted to see. And I made a point of picking out those in the government, especially, who I wanted to see. And I was able to see everyone but one person I could, who would not meet with me. His name is Li Jiangxu. He now is on the Standing Committee of the Politburo. In a certain sense, he's President Xi's right-hand person.
What do you make of the current state of relations between the US and China? One of the reasons that we're talking about this week is this argument between the US and China over the Winter Olympics. The US has said it's going to boycott the Games, essentially. It doesn't want to let China use this as sports washing is the phrase, isn't it? Use this kind of big international fanfare to maybe cover up some of the more questionable things that it's doing. Is this a sort of souring in relations? Because it seems like only recently after the COP26 climate conference that there was a kind of constructive relationship between the US and China.
Well, it's much more tense now. I served as ambassador to China 2014, 2017, 3 years. But since then, since my departure, the relationship has clearly soured. It's soured significantly. I think it's various reasons. One, just natural. China is a rising power. We've all heard about the Thucydides trap. Many people talk about it, where rising power threatens a larger established power.
it's natural. And like Americans in the West are very concerned about rising China. Don't forget, China is a huge country. China produces half of the world's steel, half the world's coal, one time half the world's aluminum, consume half the world's power. And on the road, I wouldn't be too surprised if they have more than half the world's artificial intelligence scientists and deep learning scientists and quantum computing scientists and semiconductor chip production. They're very large, and they're very focused. They're very organized, and they will do very, very well. That's all. Point number one is some of this is just natural, a rising power versus an established power. Second is the rhetoric during the Trump administration, when President Trump called the virus that originated in China the Wuhan virus, that really caused a lot of Americans to be very upset with China and caused the Chinese to dig in. They're very upset with being tagged with so-called Wuhan virus. It was a mistake. It's an accident. Whether it's natural from an animal or out of a lab, still it's accidental. It very much upset the Chinese. But that is just an example of the harsh rhetoric, superheated rhetoric from the United States criticizing China in many, many ways, criticizing China for human rights abuses in Xinjiang province, criticizing China for human rights violations in Hong Kong, and sanctioning Chinese based upon those alleged human rights violations. Add to that, America be very exercising its number three, its national security rights, as it should, to protect the United States by sanctioning certain U.S. companies or Chinese companies that might threaten U.S. national security or build up the Chinese military. And that's all those actions just are a form of decoupling, and which do sound good in the United States as part of United States values and principles, but which caused the Chinese to double down, to dig down and become much more self-sufficient and develop their own products. Mm-hmm. And this gets to the supply chain question. There are major reasons why we have big supply chain problems in the world today. One's clearly COVID, but another is because when the United States began to exercise its national security rights, let's say prevent Chinese companies from getting U.S. Semiconductors or machines that manufacture semiconductors, that caused a big major consumers of semiconductors like Huawei to buy up as much as they could. That put pressure on other companies. And, semiconductors are used in so many different industries, even in IoT and refrigerators. I mean, you name it. And all that is added to the restrictions that caused the supply chain problem. So things have changed significantly in the last several years.
And away from that inward stuff happening within China, what about their kind of outward excursions? And I'm thinking about Taiwan and how concerned you are about what might arise out of what China might proactively do about their difficult relationship with Taiwan. US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin only this week was saying that he was concerned that the Chinese were basically doing rehearsals for military operations against Taiwan. What does the West, what does NATO do in response to that if it happens?
When I was serving in Beijing, often, whether it's President Xi Jinping or the special representative, I've forgotten his name now, who represented Taiwan, man, oh man, over and over again, they just tell me how special Taiwan was. That Taiwan's a core issue to China. It's existential, along with Hong Kong, Xinjiang, and Tibet. I mean, any outside effort to undermine that addresses China's sense of its own existentialism. You don't tamper with that. And Taiwan is one. I think that China will do whatever it takes to try to get control of Taiwan. They'll play the long game. Don't forget it was either Mao or Deng Xiaoping who said to either Nixon or Kissinger, hey, when the question of Taiwan came up, oh, no, we won't deal with Taiwan right now. We'll put that off on the shelf. We'll deal with that later. It just let it simmer. The point being that the Chinese are very patient. They'll work with Taiwan. They'll try to connect, develop ties with Taiwan. I was once down in Fujian province, talking to this party secretary in Fujian province. It's on the, it's a coastal province in China, just opposite Taiwan. Man, I was a little naive. I said to the party secretary, gee, you know, we're a little concerned about all those islands being developed in the South China Sea. Well, he looked at me and he kind of laughed and said, we don't care anything about that. We just care about Taiwan. We love Taiwan. We love all the business we have here from Taiwan. We're developing just great, you know, trade relations and commercial relations with Taiwan. So China will work hard to develop Taiwan. Now, China, in my judgment, may, I think it's highly unlikely, may attempt some kind of coercive action against Taiwan. But that's as far as it goes. China is not a military aggressive country. It just isn't. There are border skirmishes with India. That's been going on for ages. That's not going to amount to much. Taiwan, if they ever get control of Taiwan militarily, they'll stop. Their main goal, China's main goal, is economic development, building up their own economy, developing ties, economic ties, developing ties in Africa, ports around the world. It's all economic. There's no real history. If you look at China's history of military aggression, they point to the United States, say, look what you Americans have done. You've gone to Iraq and Afghanistan. You went to Korea, went to Vietnam. I mean, they have not been aggressive militarily. Economically, yes, but not militarily.
Well, we'll hear from somebody who disagrees with that in a moment. That was Ambassador Max Baucus, US ambassador to China from 2014 to 2017. We're continuing our international affairs tour, looking at what various countries want this morning. China. Now, Reinhard Bütikofer, who chairs the European Parliament's China delegation.
The vision that Chinese military, party and state leader Xi Jinping has laid out for his country is that by the middle of this century, China wants to be the dominating power on the globe. And China pursues that aim with an ever more aggressive foreign policy.
And when you say aggressive foreign policy, we were just hearing from a former US ambassador to Beijing, and he said economic aggression, yes, but not militaristic.
Oh, isn't that interesting? I recall the clashes we had just recently along the Himalayan border. I recall military coercion against the Philippines and other neighbors in the South China Sea. I recall increasing incursions from the Chinese Air Force into the Air Defense Identification Zone of Taiwan. I recall very aggressive measures in the East China Sea. So maybe your source should look at those instances.
And in terms of the economic side of things, what concerns you about what China is doing? I guess particularly in some of the developing world, Africa is always pointed out as a place where there is lots of inward investment from China. Many people concerned about China's motives in doing that.
Look, I can't possibly argue that investment from third countries in Africa is a negative. It always depends on the conditions and the purposes. If there is huge investment into building more coal-fired power plants, that's obviously a negative. Investment into renewables might be judged very differently. If there is an investment that makes you economically dependent and limits the scope of your own policy decisions in such a recipient country, I would consider that a negative. So I think there's no point in being extremely general in assessments. You have to look at the facts. But in order to criticize China's economic coercion, we don't have to travel all the way to Africa. We can stay in Europe. and we can address the situation that we're presently experiencing in Lithuania, where China tries to force that country into compliance with a Chinese policy that the European Union has never signed up to. So this is something that we want to stand up against, and that's why the EU has been working on an anti-coercion instrument.
And what is that exactly, and how could it work?
It will be an economic instrument that could be applied if a third country tries to interfere illegally with the decision-making responsibilities of the EU or an EU member state, and the reaction would be possibly economic. Of course, the instrument would also foresee offering the aggressive country a way out. We would want to negotiate. We would want to give them an off-ramp. But if they would insist on their coercive measures, there could be economic countermeasures from the side of the EU, including sanctions, including denying access to the European market, what have you.
Because what do you think China's motives are in doing that? To take the Lithuania example, I don't want to get into Russia, but it's clear what Russia wants in terms of undermining the integrity of the EU. On the Chinese side, is it clear exactly what they're up to? Is it something similar to Vladimir Putin?
China is a different player, much more powerful, much more ambitious than Putin is. So I would not put the two in the same box, even though both of them are dictators. China clearly, China does not have revisionist territorial claims like Putin does, but China certainly wants to impose its political will on other countries. And in this case, that was initiated, the measures were brought against Lithuania because Lithuania changed the name of a Taiwan representation office from Taipei to Taiwan. This is well within the limits of the European One China policy. So China doesn't have a claim. The same applies to Australia. If you want to take another example, where because the Australian government demanded that there should be a reckoning of the origin of the COVID-19 pandemic, China thought that they should punish Australia. This is just unacceptable behavior, and we should opt for a strategic solidarity between democracies.
And just finally, on that idea of all banding together on this kind of thing, what do you make of the current situation with regards to the Winter Olympics in Beijing, the UK, Canada and Australia now boycotting it? Should all EU countries get behind that effort as well? And do you think that kind of action actually works in trying to, I guess, you know, from the US perspective, steering China away from indulging in genocide in Xinjiang?
No, it does not. I don't think that the Chinese Communist Party will refrain from its crimes against humanity in Xinjiang because we boycott the Olympic Winter Games, but still we should. The European Parliament has called for that with an overwhelming majority, and I'm happy to see that now an increasing number of countries announced that they will follow that path. And by the way, the president of Germany just announced that he would not be going to Taiwan, to Beijing. And also, according to the information that I have, not a single German politician has signaled that they would want to be attending the Olympics in Beijing. So I'm happy with that.
That's Reinhard Bütikofer, who chairs the European Parliament's China delegation. So we've heard former ambassador from the US to Beijing. We've heard that view there from the European Parliament. What about the UK and where we sit in all of this? Vila Nowens is a senior research fellow for Asia Studies at the Royal United Services Institute think tank. Morning, Vila.
Good morning.
In terms of how the UK should be approaching this, first of all, should we just deal with what happened yesterday in terms of the UK joining this boycott about the Winter Olympics in Beijing in 2022, joining Canada and Australia and the rest of them? Is that consistent with how the UK has approached China or wanted to approach China?
Yeah, I think it has. I mean, I think over the last few years, you've seen an increasingly more skeptical stance towards China. That, of course, is one that I think the government still tries to turn into a balanced approach. But I think there's no doubt about that the UK has taken a more stronger stance on human rights issues when it comes to China. And it's been both vocal in its statements, both in its own statements, but those with partners as well. And it's also, you know, levied sanctions against China for some of those human rights abuses and, of course, responded to the situation in Hong Kong quite strongly. So this is just an additional measure on top of that.
And in terms of, I mean, we just heard from our two previous interviews, in terms of things that China aims for, is looking for in terms of maybe military aggression, if we're talking about Taiwan, in terms of economics, in terms of the investment it's putting into developing nations, particularly Africa, looking for influence. In terms of the UK's position, what is troubling about what China does in terms of foreign affairs? What is concerning our own Foreign Office?
I mean, that's quite broad, but I think there are a number of things. You know, there's the issues, I guess, in the bilateral relationship that directly impact the UK. Of course, there's, you know, issues around investments being scrutinized more, protecting UK sovereignty and protecting UK intellectual property, for example, and strengths in some of these key areas. There's concerns around Hong Kong, as I've already mentioned, which, of course, already has impacted the bilateral relationship, given historical issues. But then also more generally, I think it's how China behaves in the international order and in the international arena, what that means for the rules that we all rely on, and whether that means that we're all on an equal playing field or not. That directly and indirectly impacts both the UK and other countries in the region that you know, are not necessarily great powers and have to rely on a framework that we all abide by.
And so much of this is now being done as the West, or at least the collection of US, Canada, Australia, UK. Is that how things are going to work? The UK doing things on its own, reacting to things that China does by itself, is going to achieve very little?
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think, of course, you are stronger in numbers, but it's important to also maintain your own strategic autonomy and do what's in your own interest. So I think it'll be a mixture of both. But what we have been seeing is that countries are realizing that, you know, working through these smaller groupings is actually a really easy way to move the needle in the debate and bring, you know, the discussion more prominently in the media as well. So, you know, that mini lateralism that we see evolving is something that I think is here to stay for sure.
And that's where we end our look at China and international relations and what they want. I hope you found it useful. I certainly did. If you want to subscribe to this podcast, it's a very useful thing to do. It helps you. It helps us. Rate it if you like. And you can follow me on Twitter as well if you like, at LukeJones03. I realised yesterday the podcast wasn't uploaded because I didn't get the usual smattering of, let's be honest, slightly nerdy people follow me on Twitter, which whenever I do this podcast, there's a stream of people and I think, why are all these sort of think tanky types following me? Oh, it's because I'm doing the Times Red Box podcast. So welcome along if that is you. And we'll be back tomorrow.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.